When we were back at the session in March, Mr. Jim Franks went through a comparative religion presentation where he did a PowerPoint presentation on quite a number of splinter groups that are out there. Nothing derogatory, just basically get the facts type approach of this is what so-and-so preaches, this is what so-and-so teaches, and this is the background of what somebody else might teach. Just because we've run onto some of those issues from time to time. And Mr. Franks did an excellent job showing where the differences would be in what they teach, and certainly also some of the background. What was striking is not only how many individuals out there today proclaim to be some sort of special messenger from God. They proclaim they may be, the anointed, they may be the next apostle. Many have taken that title to themselves. It's also surprising how many of them claim, or several especially, that claim to be one of the two witnesses. It's not really surprising. Down through history, many people have thought they were one of the two witnesses. The reason, obviously, is that demons or delusion cause people to think they are some sort of special messenger from God. They read the Bible and they, get this sort of delusional approach to themselves, and they then assume they must be one of the two witnesses. And, of course, many have claimed that down through time. Mr. Armstrong, one time I heard him say that 14 people that he knew of had come up to him and said they were one of the two witnesses. That obviously is 12 more than necessary. And at one point I heard there were three people at one time came and said they were the two witnesses. I can't verify that, but it doesn't make any sense. But certainly there are a lot of people who want that job. Now, if you look at what happens to the two witnesses, they get stoned and their bodies lay there in Jerusalem for 3 days. This is not something anybody should want to do. I mean, if there's job applications out there, please everybody fill them out. This is not one that I think any of us would be anxious for. Down through history, there have always been people who looked into the Bible and had some delusional, crazy idea that it was about them. About 10 years ago, some of us remember the Hale-Bopp Comet episode where the Hale-Bopp Comet came close to the U.S., close to the globe. It was the Earth. I think it was the closest any comet had been in several centuries. And there was a small group down in San Diego that put on special kinds of tennis shoes and then all took some sort of poison. I believe there were 20 or 30 of them they found dead up in this dormitory-type room. Their leaders were called Bo and Peep, and they claimed to be the two witnesses, and they said that Revelation 11 was about them, and that when this comet got close to the Earth, all these dead people were all going to go up and join the comet, and that was apparently where they were going to go to heaven and do some special thing. Who knows what it was? It wasn't just them. There are many others. When I was in Israel back in 1974, I'm sure things haven't changed, probably gotten worse. The Israeli police in Jerusalem had a witness, a paddy wagon. It was kind of a van. And there were so many American crazy people who would go over there and stand up on the Temple Mount or the Wailing Wall and start yelling and screaming that they were one of the two witnesses. And the Israeli police would just go grab them, throw them in the wagon, and then take them to the airport and send them right home. So there are plenty of people that get that idea. And then, of course, the authorities over in Jerusalem have to deal with it. Today, many former ministers, some even who have Church of God background, claim to have some great special calling from God, one that would be skewed and certainly unsupportable by Scripture, but nevertheless, it doesn't seem to be any lack of those people claiming those things. Now, if you look in Bible commentaries, things like Large JFB or Adam Clark or others, or if you look on many modern-day evangelical commentaries or writings on the Internet, who do most of these writers believe are the two witnesses? Anyone know? See, Tyler isn't here. Maybe Mr. Burden, Logan should know. Oh, you're half right. Who else supposedly didn't die? Enoch. So Enoch and Elijah are the two that most commentators will say are going to come back as the two witnesses, because their conclusion is Enoch didn't die, Elijah didn't die, they were wafted off to some special place. They believe perhaps heaven, it just says God took them. And so they believe Enoch and Elijah will then come back and become the two witnesses at some point. Fair enough, I guess that's what they assume. And they don't understand that Enoch is listed in Hebrews 11 as having died in the faith and not having received the promises. But that doesn't seem to bother their understanding. So some believe that Enoch and Elijah, of course, there are prophecies about Elijah coming in the end time. Christ is very clear that John the Baptist fulfilled that in his time, so it can easily be fulfilled by another individual who comes in the spirit and power of Elijah but does not have to be Elijah himself. Now, the first question we have to ask is, what is their message? What is the message of the two witnesses? You know, we hear precious little about their message. We just hear about lots of people who want to be them and want to be, apparently, you know, some sort of special calling they see themselves in. But so little is said about what is the message of these men. Would we be able to recognize the message if we heard it? Would it be something that all of us could say, that is the true messenger from God because I hear him saying blank, blank, blank? If I were to ask all of us to write down in our notes, the two witnesses will come and they will say, you know, in 10 words, what will they say? You know, most of us would have a difficult time coming up with, okay, what are they going to do? What is their message? Why does their message make the world so angry they are killed? Because whatever they say really is not accepted. You know, the world gets mad at them. The people over in Jerusalem eventually stone them, and they are left to rot their bodies in Jerusalem while the world celebrates. So something about their message makes people so angry that they are killed, and the entire world then celebrates them being dead. The next thing we have to understand is that millions of people are going to be fooled into thinking these guys ought to be killed. If the entire world rejoices over their death, then the entire world has been deceived by Satan the devil and believes a different message and does not want to accept the message that these two men are given. Now, if we were going to take the typical Bible exegetical approach, I could say hermeneutical approach, but both of those are confusing words. Exegesis means speaking out from the Bible, the Scriptures. Hermeneutical means the tools or the methods you use to understand the Scriptures. So if we were typical exegesis and hermeneutics people, which we're hopefully not, we would simply turn to Revelation 11, read it, and go, aha, and we'd close our Bible, and then we would sit in our swing and stare off into the distance and try to figure out what does that verse or those verses mean. That is typically the way Protestant doctrinal decisions are made. People read one or two verses, and then they stop and think about it for a little while, and then they get heartburn, and then they come up with some doctrinal statement, and that becomes the basis for their church. I'm exaggerating, but frankly, not too much. How many churches do you know of that are based on a misunderstanding of one verse? I could think of about four or five right off the bat if I wanted to talk about them in public, which I don't. So what I'm saying is we are not going to turn to Revelation 11 first and just read it and say that's all there is, God doesn't tell us anything else, and then sit around and try to figure out what it means. We will certainly come to false conclusions if we were. The truth of the matter is the Bible is written here a little, there a little, that God does give us background, he gives us information, he gives us all sorts of truth to lead up to anything like the two witnesses that we have in Revelation chapter 11. Revelation 11 is the last chapter in Revelation is the last book in the Bible, and we really have to build upon the foundation of the first 65 books in order to understand it. We cannot just take our scissors out and start cutting verses and pieces out of Revelation and then sitting back and, you know, trying to go off into mental gymnastics figuring out what it says. So let's go back and get some real background before we try to turn to Revelation 11 and decipher it. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17. This is the first place where the phrase two witnesses is mentioned. And it is important that we understand why God said there were to be a minimum of two witnesses and also what subject they were to give their affirmation about. So this will tell us something about the message that the two witnesses will someday give, and we should be able to recognize it. So as we look in this part of Deuteronomy and some other verses here, let's understand what God originally intended the message of two witnesses to be about. Deuteronomy 17 and verse 1, "You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God a bull or sheep which has any blemish or defect, for that is an abomination to the Lord your God." We are not to offer a defective sacrifice to God. It includes our own life and it includes any sheep, of course, back then. "If there is found among you within any of your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman who has been wicked in the sight of the Lord in transgressing his covenant." So this wickedness is now described. who has gone and served other gods and worshiped them. So this wickedness involves serving other gods, worshiping false gods. And then they are described as either the sun or moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have not commanded. Now, sun and moon worship are not new. Sun and moon worship are also still here. They are not gone. As you know, the society of Egypt was a sun-worshipping society. They worshipped Ra, the sun god. They had pictures of, you know, the sun going back and forth in the sky on this big boat, kind of a Nile River boat. And, of course, all of the pharaohs of Egypt thought they were descended from Ra. They had these various, human, sort of half-human, half-animal type statues and illustrations of Ra. But Egypt was a sun-worshipping society. And much of that sun-worship idea migrated up into Europe in the form of Mithras. Most of you have heard of Mithraism. It is a kind of a codified form of sun worship with a lot of ritual and a lot of chants and sayings and belief in a variety of false gods that came from the sun. There are a number of Mithraic rituals and ideas that have come down to us today in the form of the Catholic Church. The great Church of Europe has much of what it teaches and also its rituals and what it does come from ancient Mithraism. A number of years ago, my wife and I went to Rome for the feast. I don't know how many of you have been to Italy for the feast, but there is, not too far from the Colosseum, just down about four or five blocks, there is a Catholic church, and three floors under that in the basement is still a Mithraism temple, a temple to Mithras. And what they say is that was the temple there during the Roman period, the first century, and with all the city debris and building up and building this new church on top of it and another church on top of that. But it's interesting that the modern day Catholic church is built on top of a temple of Mithras. I've also heard some indication, I think it was from Dr. Hay or Dr. Dorothy years ago, that St. Peter's Basilica, under that basilica, of course, is supposed to be this crypt that contains St. Peter's bones, but that also may very well have been a temple of Mithras before the St. Peter's was built on top of it. So sun worship, Mithraism, and the sun worship of Ra, the ancient sun god, is still with us today. It is with us in festivals called Easter, Christmas, and other things. Of course, up in places in Celtic Britain, they have the Druids who celebrate, the summer equinox or the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. But sun worship was something God did not tolerate. And if there was a person who was involved in sun worship, God says if there's someone found among you transgressing him, that they should be eliminated or removed from Israel. There's also moon worship. So he says either the sun or the moon. And moon worship today, of course, came from ancient Babylon. Babylon was a moon-worshipping society. Josephus is pretty clear about that, as are many commentaries. Most of that moon worship has come down to us today in the form of the Mohammed religion or the Muslims. If you go on many websites, they're very clear they worship the moon god of Arabia. And, of course, Zoroastrianism and some of the other tenets of that moon-worshipping society were inculcated and written down and, of course, are followed today by the followers of that religion. And so we still have very predominant moon and sun worship in the world today. And God says, if anyone has done that, he says in verse 4, and it is told you, and you should hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently, if indeed it is true and certain that such an abomination has been committed in Israel, you shall bring out that man to your gates or that woman who has committed all that wicked thing, and shall stone him to death, that man or woman, with stones. Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses, not one. Notice that the witnesses would have to have seen this person or heard this person teaching sun or moon worship. But the first time we find the two witnesses in the Bible, they are publicly accusing or publicly pointing out this sun and moon worship and the worship of the host of heaven that is going on, and it is, of course, an abomination in God's eyes, and those people were to be removed. Notice verse 7, the hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death. So the first guys to pick up rocks or stones and throw them would be these two witnesses who said this person, whether it was a man or a woman, was worshiping the sun or worshiping the moon or teaching that in Israel. And it says, afterwards, the hands of all the people would take up stones and throw them. So you shall put away evil from among you. So they have several things required here. First was the testimony of two witnesses, not one. No one person could make an accusation and then have some sort of penalty carried out. This is the first phrase involving the death penalty for idolatry. It's the first phrase that says these witnesses were to testify against it. Now let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 19. Obviously, the two witnesses in Revelation 11 are going to have a great deal to say about sun and moon worship that is going on in the world that they come into or are called to witness against. So false religion, sun and moon worship, is the first message we could look for when the two witnesses come on the scene, a message against that. The next time two witnesses are used is Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 14. It says, you shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set in your inheritance, which you will inherit in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. So this is looking forward to the time when Joshua, and we have a pretty good record of it in his book, would set the land of Israel according to the 12 tribes and the leaders of the 12 tribes and, of course, then the families. And they would put these landmarks. They were just stones. I assume they had something written on them. But these landmarks were essentially survey markers. Now, today we have survey markers, too. We have, you know, stakes in the ground and various things. If you've hiked the big hill just up to where the Pates live at Eatonville, on the very top of the kind of the tall peak to the south there, there is a big round concrete marker. And it says Bonneville Power Administration. It's got a marker. It says survey marker on it. It's interesting that it says, do not move under penalty of law. So you can't move the survey marker once the law is there. Once this says this is the boundary, it's not allowed to be moved. So even today we are applying some of these principles in our land. So you shall not remove your neighbor's landmark. Once the land of Israel was set up among the families, each family had their own inheritance. The landmarks were never to be moved. That land was to go back to the original families if it were lost for any reason, every 50 years. So wouldn't that be wonderful if that had still stayed the same today, if we would not allow huge corporations and foreigners to buy up our productive farmland and that under the original Land Settlement Act of 1878, every family had 160 or 320 acres maximum that would always come back into the family. Certainly would make it a much different place economically for all of us. In fact, it would guarantee prosperity, but that wouldn't be what our nation would choose to do right now, apparently. So it says in verse 15, one witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. So in the context of not removing a landmark, we have the same principle that it would take two witnesses to say this man did something wrong. He moved a landmark. So we have these witnesses giving their testimony over ownership of land that was assigned to Israel by Joshua. Now that same land today, I'm sure some of those landmarks might still be there, but most I would guess are gone. But that same land is still involved in controversy. It has been for generations, but certainly since 1948 and the Israeli War for Independence, there has been an ongoing war between Ishmaelites, Edomites, Philistines, and Jews over the ownership of this same land. So when we find Daniel 11 and verse 40, which we'll get to later, the beast power comes in. We will have three groups all saying this land belongs to us. We will have the Jews. We will have the Palestinians, who, of course, are descended from Ishmael and the Philistines, and then the Edomites, and then obviously the beast power, those from Europe who would come in. So these two witnesses that come on the scene in Revelation 11 will very likely have a great deal to say about who really owns that land, because they were used back in the time of Moses and, of course, Joshua and others, that they had to have their testimony before they would say who owned a land. So this was established by at least two witnesses. It's interesting, it says here that one witness, verse 15, shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. It would be nice if we would do this in our land, So often today, based on a false report from one witness, a person's reputation is slandered and ruined. Who was the politician back in, I think it was President Reagan's day, that said, where do I go to get my reputation back? I think it was a cabinet member named Allen that had been slandered, and of course it was all over the news, and after months he was completely acquitted, and then he said, where do I go to get my reputation back? And now it's proven that all of these things were completely false. So there really needs to be two witnesses, and there should be. Our media should never report accusations against a person unless they have been convicted or they have two complete witnesses, and then they could at least make the accusation known. But so often now we have only one witness, and even then it's often very, very suspect. The person, you know, may or may not have another political reason behind what they're saying. And sometimes we find even family members make false accusations against family members, and then men or others who are completely ruined for life, it seems, because of that. So if we would follow this principle in our court system, it would certainly do a great deal towards making it a much better court system. You know, there can be a second evidence witness, something like DNA, something like perhaps, let's say you had, you know, blood on the floor of the Bronco that matched the blood that was all over the sidewalk at the person's house. I'm not talking about any particular murder, of course, but you know, that would be two very clear witnesses that perhaps the person, you know, was guilty who was driving the Bronco. But I'm just saying that, you know, the witness doesn't necessarily just have to be somebody who was some person, but also could be some very obvious evidence. Now, the witness has to be someone who saw the event, not somebody who was recruited, not somebody who, you know, happened to be a good buddy of somebody else and was talked into going and taking an advocacy. That's not it. That doesn't follow the principle of being a witness at all. The witnesses actually saw the crime and saw what took place. Now, let's go over to one example of where this was used, Ruth chapter 4. I thought about spending some time, and there's so many other examples of two guys working together. You talk about maybe, let's think about it for a minute. Moses and Aaron worked together. Elijah and Elisha, perhaps. One of the other examples of two witnesses would be Joshua and Caleb, who came back from surveying the promised land. And they said, oh yes, we can take it, we can do it. And the other 10 who went with them, of course, were scared and lacked faith, certainly were not men of courage. We can talk about others, perhaps Paul and Silas, Paul and Barnabas, James and John, or Peter and John. We might do some sort of a study of people who went out two by two to do a job together or preach for God. That's an interesting study in itself, but I didn't want to take the time to go through all of those because most of those didn't have a message pertaining to the Revelation 11 two witnesses. But here in Ruth chapter 4, this is an example of land ownership being carried out just like what Moses had instructed in Deuteronomy 19. In chapter 4 and verse 1, we have Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. Now Boaz, of course, wanted to marry Ruth. Most of you know the story fairly well. Naomi went to a far country, and of course her husband died. His name was Elimelech. And then her two sons, who had both married girls, died. So she had these two daughters-in-law who went back with her to the land of Israel, and they ended up on Boaz's place gleaning and surviving on what they could collect up. Actually, just Ruth went. The other girl didn't. So Ruth and Naomi showed up. And so then eventually Boaz fell in love with Ruth, you know the story, and she also slept, you know, near him on the threshing floor to claim her inheritance, because she would have been then the one to claim the land that would have been owned by Elimelech. And Boaz was a close relative. So Boaz went up to the gate and sat down, and this is the gate of the city where all the leaders would come in and out. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So there was a closer relative who could have claimed that he was the one to inherit the land. So he came by. Boaz said, come aside, friend, sit down. So he came and sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city. He only had to take two. Two witnesses were required, but Boaz here took 10 witnesses. And all that tells you is that he was very determined or enthusiastic about marrying Ruth. You know, he could have been kind of, you know, flaccid and unsure, and well, I'm not sure I'm quite up to it, and I'll think about it for a few more years, and you know, the way a lot of young men do today when it comes to getting married. But he was a little more enthusiastic. I think he impressed Ruth that this was really what he wanted to do. So he brought 10 men 10 men of the city that came with him. So he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. They weren't really brothers, they were kind of cousins and uncles and all of that. But I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me. So the land was to go back to the original family. There was a price to pay for it. But he said, if there is no one but you to redeem it, then I am next after you. So this other relative, who is not named, says, well, I will redeem it. Yeah, a nice piece of land, probably has vineyards, probably has some good pasture for sheep and cattle and all that. So I'll redeem the land, sure, I'd like to have some more land. And Boaz said, well, now there's, you know, a package deal here. On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead. So the husband that would have inherited the land is dead, but his widow is here. So when she gets married again, then the child she has, especially the first son, would be the one to inherit the land. So if you're going to buy the land, you're only going to have it until she has a son. As soon as he's of age, then it becomes his, not yours. So it says to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. Now this changed the mind of the close relative. Very likely he already had a wife and two or three sons, maybe four or five sons, maybe two or three wives, probably not, probably only one. But the idea of taking on a second wife and having more kids that eventually inherit somebody else's property anyway did not appeal to him. I think most of us men, if somebody said, you want to get married to another lady, most of us would say, no, one is quite all we need. We don't need to buy more nylons, and you know, we only have one bathroom full of blow dryers and curling irons. We simply cannot handle any more than this. And certainly, this close relative felt his plate was full. A free piece of land is one thing, but another wife and a bunch of inheritance problems is quite another. So it says here, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm any one thing. The one man took off his sandal, so the land I walked on basically is symbolized by the sandal, and he gave it to another. This was a confirmation in Israel. Therefore, the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. So he took off his sandal, and Boaz said to the elders and all the people. So there would have been far more than just the 10 witnesses here. There may have been a pretty good sized crowd gathered. You are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilon's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. Probably the son would be named Mahlon, or Mahlon, that he may not be cut off among his brethren. And from his position at the gate, you are witnesses this day, all the people who were at the gate, and the elders said, we are witnesses. So this is as good as going down to the title company and getting it all signed off and recorded at the courthouse. It says that they gave her a blessing. And verse 13 just says, Boaz took Ruth to be his wife, and when he went to her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. So then, legally, Mahlon had himself a son, even though Mahlon was already dead by that time. So the principle of this witnessing of the land ownership was even carried out, at least as one case we have record of. Now the principle of having two witnesses to establish something is consistent throughout the Bible. Let's go over to what may be the most vivid account from the Gospels, Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. Now if there is one section of Scripture that we have probably misused and misapplied and caused a lot of hard feelings more than any other, I would guess it would be this one. I would vote for this one above all others. The context of Matthew 18 is going to your brother. Oftentimes we have superficially read this and taken off and gone and accused somebody else of something only to find out they didn't see it that way. And then since there wasn't anybody else on our, you know, who had seen what had happened, then we go and find two or three friends, and we recruit them to be our advocates, so we pretend they're witnesses when they're not, so we go talk to them again, and the whole thing just blows up and becomes a big mess. So if that was not was what intended, what was intended in this chapter? Let's look at it in some context first. Verse 15 just says, moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone, and if he hears you, you have gained your brother. Verse 16, though, says, if he will not hear you, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. So that's obviously a direct quote from Deuteronomy 17. Now, let's go back and get the context of this verse. We can't just pull it out of place, misapply it, and then think, well, it must not work. Christ must have been wrong when he said that. Verse 10, take heed you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. So it's a warning about little ones. It says, for the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. So the context is those who are lost. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountains to seek the one that's straying? So the context here is a lost sheep, a sheep who has left the flock and is now out straying on his own and needs to have someone go and seek him and bring him back into the flock. And if he should find it, assuredly I say to you, he rejoices more over that sheep than the 99 who have not gone astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. God wants everyone, all the little ones in his flock, to make it. Then verse 15 does not start a new chapter. It doesn't start with a new thought. It really continues. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. So the way I understand this is the context here, is your brother doing something that might cause him to lose salvation, some sinful activity, a continuing of the concept of a sheep going astray, and the shepherd going out to find him. So if you see your brother do some kind of sin like that, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. And if he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he won't hear you, take two or three witnesses with you. Now these would not be people that you recruit to be on your side in some sort of an argument so you can win the argument. And that's the way it normally is done. And of course, that is going to backfire. You would take other people who perhaps understand that what this person is doing, whether it's delving into heresy or perhaps, you know, breaking one of the commandments openly or not attending church like they should, whatever it might be, that they would understand they've also seen it, they also are concerned, and they would then go with you to say, look, all of us are concerned about your spiritual condition. We don't want you to, you know, be shipwrecked spiritually speaking. And the book of James talks about, if you save one from the fire, you know, you have done a good thing. That's a loose paraphrase, but that's the idea, that if one turns a brother who has, he can see is in a, heading in the wrong direction. So it says here, verse 17, if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. So take it to the church leadership that, you know, Joe or Sam or Tom or whoever it is doing something here that is endangering his spiritual salvation. But if he refuses to even hear the church, then let him be to you like a heathen or a tax collector. In other words, this is something that would qualify him for being disfellowshipped and no longer a part of the body of Christ. So this was a very important principle. And I think if we look at the context of Matthew 18, it puts a slightly different glow on this chapter and understanding than when we just kind of pull it out of context and use it to try to solve these little personal offenses and things that that you know happen from time to time in God's family. Now let's go over to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew 26, concerning Christ's trial. One of the strange things about the trial here of Christ is that the Pharisees obeyed several of the laws in Deuteronomy, and they disobeyed several of the laws in Deuteronomy. So here we have Matthew 26 and verse 57, where they knew they had to have two witnesses that would come to this court. Now, in the time of Jesus Christ, in the time of the first century, there were two court systems in Palestine, in Jerusalem. The lower court, so to speak, was the court of the Jews. The Pharisees, the Jews had their priesthood there, they had their Sanhedrin, and they could have their own trials, and they could even do things like have people, you know, receive, you know, a beating of 39 lashes. Remember, the Apostle Paul was beaten by the Jews several times and 40 times minus one. They could not put people to death. They could imprison people temporarily. They could also, you know, deport them. They could have them kicked out of the land and sent to a foreign country. But they could not use the capital punishment. The Roman system under Pilate and the Roman governors, was a much more efficient and quick system, and they could carry out whatever the Roman decree was because they were the final authority and accountable only to Caesar over in Rome. So the Jews here had a dilemma. They wanted to put Christ to death, but they had to first condemn him in their own court and then take him to Pilate and try to force Pilate to have him condemned. So in Matthew chapter 26 and verse 57, it says, those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest. If you haven't done so, be sure and read the information about Caiaphas in the Biblical Archaeology Review. And, of course, I think he's quite a number of articles on the Internet. About 12 years ago, they found Caiaphas's ossuary, the box containing his bones, in a priest tomb down in kind of south of the Ophel, south of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And it was found in situ, which means it was found undisturbed. It had never been unearthed before. And the name Caiaphas is a strange name. It's nowhere else in history. It's proof that, you know, archaeology is one more proof of the Bible. But Caiaphas's name was on the outside of the sarcophagus or of the ossuary, they call it. And I think that today is in one of the antiquities museums in Jerusalem. But this guy, Caiaphas, was a scoundrel. He was the one that orchestrated Christ's death. He was the high priest at the time. But then sort of as a way to get back at him, you know, God preserved his bones to where he could be one of the best witnesses of the truth of what Matthew and others wrote here in the Gospels to those in our time. So Jesus was led away to the high priest's house, Caiaphas, where the scribes and elders were assembled. Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard. When he went in, he sat, and his servants came to see the end. Now, Peter followed so that later, of course, Peter could give an account in his book about what Jesus Christ went through when he was on trial. Now, the chief priests and the elders and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Now, what's interesting in verse 59 is what really happened is they tried to find, you know, these witnesses who would say something against Jesus. But following the principle that they knew was in Deuteronomy, these witnesses had to be interviewed alone. They couldn't have five of them in a room, and one guy said, well, I heard him say this, and everybody else nods their head like nodding head dolls and agrees, and therefore they've got five witnesses. They would actually bring each one of these men in separate in front of a small group of these priests and say, well, what do you know? What can you say about what this man did? And so very likely what happened is one of them said, well, I saw him feed 5,000 people. And somebody else said, well, you know, I saw him, you know, get on the boat and disappear and come back 30 miles, you know, somewhere else. And somebody else said, well, I saw him heal this daughter of this guy named Jairus. And somebody else said, well, I was there when he yelled at the tomb and Lazarus came out. So all of these stories started coming out that were all different. They did not agree. So finally, it says in verse 60, they found none, even though many witnesses came forward. And some of these people might have thought this was their chance to curry favor with the high priest, with Caiaphas and his crowd. It says, finally, two false witnesses came forward. So as all this was playing out, apparently two guys got together back out in the street somewhere and said, well, let's go in there and pretend that we haven't talked to each other. Let's both give the same story. So that's what they did. They said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days. And of course, that wasn't what he said. He said, you destroy this temple, and it will be rebuilt in 3 days. So just to get up and say, well, I'm Samson or I'm some great strong guy, I can destroy the temple, that in itself would just be sort of laughable, but that's what they came up with that he said. It's just interesting to have an example here of how Satan works, mixing truth with lies, because the story is not accurate about what he said. So the high priest arose and said to him, do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent, and the high priest answered and said to him, I put you under oath by the living God, which apparently the high priest had authority to do that. If they were on trial, put him under oath and say, tell us if you are Christ, the Son of God. So he had to answer. He could not keep silent. So Jesus said to him, it is as you said. You know, the accusation you gave me is true. I am the Christ, the Son of God. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. Of course, what he had spoken was the truth. But the high priest heard it, and so did others. So they said, what further need do we have of witnesses? Look, you have heard his blasphemy. So now they thought they had all they needed to go to Pilate and to have him put to death, have him have this death penalty. So they felt they had enough then for the Romans. And of course, we all know the story of what happened here later. They spat on him and hit him in various things and carried him off to this kangaroo court. But now let's go over to John chapter 8, because Jesus himself followed the principle that it requires two witnesses to establish a firm fact about someone. In this case, the witness was himself and his father, because it was the question was, is he or is he not the Messiah? John chapter 8 and verse 13, the Pharisees therefore said to him, and see, these Pharisees are doctors of the law, and they understand Deuteronomy, and they understood Moses' words, at least wise superficial from a legal standpoint. The Pharisees said to him, you bear witness of yourself, therefore your witness is not true. In fact, if you look at the correct translation of the last sentence in verse 13, it says, your witness is not valid as testimony. One person cannot get up and give witness of themselves. There would have to be a second witness. So they're saying, well, because there's only one, what you're saying about who you are is not true. Jesus answered and said to them, even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true. He said, no, what I'm saying to you is true, even though I say it myself, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I came from or where I am going to. He said, look, you don't know where I came from, but I do. You don't know where I'm going, but I do. You judge according to the flesh what you see, but I judge no one. Yet if I don't judge, my judgment is true. Or if I do judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone. But I am the Father who sent me. He says, it is written in your law. So he's quoting what they are quoting, where they're coming from. It is written in your law that the testimony of two men is true. So the second place, at least, that we have Deuteronomy 17 quoted here in the New Testament. He says, I am one who bears witness, the miracles, the things he did, and the Father who sent me bears witness of me. Now, how did the Father bear witness of him? Well, when he was baptized, the heavens opened, and we heard this voice, you know, here is my beloved Son, who is well-pleasing to me, hear you him. At the Transfiguration, the voice again was heard, and of course, when Christ was crucified, there was a huge earthquake, the earth became black, there was a lot of wind, and of course, you might even also look at some of the, you know, bringing Lazarus and others back to life, but the very voice of God, on at least two occasions, mentioned loudly for all to hear that this was his Son, and it was sent from him. So there were two witnesses. The Father bore witness of him, and also Jesus Christ himself and the miracles that he did. So they both affirmed that he was the Messiah. The Apostle Paul also followed this principle. Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 13. 2 Corinthians chapter 13. In this case, he said his first two letters to this church were witnesses. Might even say his visit with them, he stayed there for 2 years, and then his letter to them. Notice that in the first part of 1 Corinthians, don't have time to go through, but if you look at 1 Corinthians, we went through there earlier, that three witnesses of what was going on in Corinth came back to Paul and said, we have these problems in Corinth. People are divided. We have all these different teachers they're following. We have, you know, this guy living in adultery, all these things going on. And so it required, they knew it required at least two, and the church leadership in Corinth sent three witnesses to Paul to establish that he had to deal with some of these problems, that those problems were true. So he wrote 1 Corinthians and now 2, and he said at the end of 2 Corinthians, here in chapter 13 and verse 1, this will be the third time I'm coming to you. Then he also quotes Deuteronomy 17:6, by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. So he said, look, I told you before, I've told you now twice, this is established, and something has to be done to change. I have told you before, and foretell as if I were present the second time. So you've had two witnesses or two warnings. And now being absent, I write to those who have sinned before, and to all the rest, that if I come again, I will not spare. Since you seek a proof of Christ speaking in me, who is not weak towards you, but mighty in you, for though he was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by the power of God. We also are weak in him, but we shall live with him by the power of God's toward us. And he tells them to examine themselves to find out whether or not they're in the faith, because they had not been motivated to change by these previous two witnesses that were given to them. So the church there, all down through the New Testament, continued to always follow this principle that two witnesses were required to establish a truth about a person, either character or action. There's one more good example over in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 17. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 17. This is one of the better chapters in the Bible on church organization. If you look through the Apostle Paul's instructions to Timothy, but also Titus, but especially Timothy, and we find that we really do try to follow these same principles in how we have church services and organize God's church today. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 17, says, "Let the elders who rule well be accounted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in word and doctrine." It does take a lot of work to explain God's truth, it takes labor to put together a message concerning God's words he gives to us, a message that can be beneficial and understandable to God's people. And so the Bible simply says, well, those who work and labor to explain his word and to make it practicable and livable for us ought to be at least worthy of honor. "For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his wages." Then it says in verse 19, "Do not receive an accusation against an elder except from two or three witnesses." Now that's interesting, that we do not receive an accusation against another minister, against any minister, any elder serving in the church, except at the mouth of two or three witnesses. Now, the truth of the matter is we shouldn't be accepting accusations against anyone unless there is evidence from two or three witnesses. But here Paul is saying elders in particular. Now, we have not always followed this. In the history of the Church of God, at least certainly my experience the last 40 years, there have been far, far too many cases where one person's animosity, where some sort of hearsay or one supposed charge of some kind, led to all sorts of havoc and hurt feelings and false accusations. And we used to have a saying years ago in the ministry that they never called you until you were swinging from a rope. And that was, back during some more difficult years. I would say that those of us today who are elders in God's church really appreciate the fact that in United we've really tried to follow this. We've tried to make some very positive changes in the way we do things. And we even have it written down as policy. And we have not only boards of appeal and ways to appeal, but I think buried in the very way we do things, we are trying to make sure that, requires two real witnesses, not one witness and one person who's been recruited by gossip, to make sure that everybody is treated fairly and justly in God's eyes. So we always should have been following that. We should always do that because it's a principle that God himself follows, and we should also before we make judgments or certainly make any penalties involved. Now, I think we have enough time to cover the next section. Satan the devil always counterfeits what God is going to do. It happened in the first century. It will happen also in our time or in the end. Before the two witnesses of God come on the scene, there will be two false witnesses sent by Satan the devil. And they will convince people of a false kingdom, and they will also convince people of a false message. Now, how do we know that? Let's go back to Acts chapter 5 in verse 27. We find that down through history, Satan the devil knows the Bible. He probably has most prophecy memorized. He doesn't understand it from the heart, obviously, but academically, he probably knows it better than any of us. So what he does is he convinces people to put up counterfeits. Now, if you were going to counterfeit a $20 bill, you want to make it look just like a real $20 bill. Now, that's why you wouldn't have me doing it, because I can't even draw a stick man. I have no artistic talent. There are some people that are great artists, just natural. You've probably known kids who are 3 or 4 or 5 years old, they're drawing this picture, and it really looks like a picture. It looks like something they're drawing, as opposed to just squiggles and lines and scratches. And, of course, as they get older, there are people who are excellent at just looking at something, and they can just make a drawing or a picture of it very well. So when you make a counterfeit, you want to make it look a lot like what the real thing is. So in Acts chapter 5 and verse 27, we have an account of that because there were two false messiahs that we know of. I would guess there were more, that we have two false messiahs recorded that Satan inspired to be on the scene in Jerusalem proclaiming themselves as a messiah before the real messiah came on the scene. Now, I'm just going to give you one of my prophetic sidelights, which may or may not prove to be true. I believe there will be several false attempts to go to the place of safety before the real one occurs. That you're going to have some of these little small groups that proclaim themselves, and they're going to get on airplanes. It's going to be a worldwide, you know, embarrassing thing in the news. All these crazy Americans over here in Jordan trying to go to Petra, and King of Jordan's going to get his army to take them back and put them on buses and send them back home. There will be some false going to the place of safety attempts. In fact, I believe there already have been a few. They just haven't been as famous as they're going to be. So Satan knows what is really going to happen. He will counterfeit it every time. Please be aware of that. Don't fall for the counterfeit. Acts chapter 5 and verse 27, they brought them before the high priest. This is Peter and some of the other apostles. And the high priest asked them, saying, "Didn't we strictly command you not to teach in this guy's name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with his doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us." So the apostles were telling everybody in Jerusalem, the high priest and the Sanhedrin, these guys killed the real Messiah. They killed the real Son of God, and that God has now raised him up, and he's at the right hand. So Peter and the other apostles said, "We're so sorry we said that. We won't say that anymore." I thought I'd see if you're still awake. No, they said, "We ought to obey God rather than man." And they said, then they repeated what they were accusing them of. These guys had some courage. "The God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you murdered by hanging on a tree." So no beating around the bush, no namby-pamby, nicey-nice stuff here. "You murdered him, put him on a tree. But God has exalted him to his right hand to be prince and savior, to give repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sin. And we are his witnesses. We saw these things with our own eyes. We were there. And so we are telling people what we actually saw. We saw him crucified. We saw him resurrected. We saw him ascend to heaven. So also is the Holy Spirit, whom God has given to those who obey." So the Holy Spirit is witness of this. And those people who are obeying God receive that Spirit from him. Now when they heard this, when these Pharisees and the Sanhedrin guys heard this, they were furious and plotted to kill them. So they follow one murder with another, with many more. Then one of the council stood up, a Pharisee named Gamaliel. This is the Pharisee that taught the Apostle Paul. And obviously he was a man of a certain amount of wisdom. He was a teacher of the law, held in respect by all the people, and commanded them to put the apostles outside for a while. So he said, "Well, put them outside for a while. There's something here I want to say." And he said to them, "Men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what you intend to do regarding these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up claiming to be somebody." So when people today rise up and they claim they are somebody important, it is nothing new. It's been going on since the time of Cain, who rose up, killed his brother, and then took off and built Jericho. And of course, after him, one of his descendants, a real nice guy named Nimrod, kind of started this whole thing about tyrants. There were tyrants in the earth. There still are tyrants in the earth. They're all over the place running little countries into the ground and raising themselves up. So he said, "Men of Israel, take guard what you do. This guy named Theudas rose up, probably, I'm just going to guess, about 10 B.C., claiming to be somebody." So he thought, "I'm the Messiah. I'm the God's anointed. I'm God's apostle. I'm God's whatever it is. I'm Hale Bopp Comet, whoever, I mean, whatever it is." Theudas said, "I'm somebody important from God." A number of men, about 400, joined him. So why is it that nutcases always get followers? That's something I have never figured out. It's kind of like the crazier message you get, the more followers you can get. Remember Jim Jones down in, was it Ghana or Guyana or somewhere? Craziness. 700 or 800 people drank poison Kool-Aid because this crazy guy was down there. The same was true today. Anybody can claim, you know, God sent me with a special message. You know, you could wear all kinds of crazy get-ups and do all kinds of things, and people would send, you know, send them money and support them. I just can't believe it. After this, Judas of Galilee rose up. So Theudas got killed, he was slain, his group scattered. So Judas of Galilee, another guy, this guy's named Judas, he rose up. Notice he was from Galilee, the same place that Christ came from, Nazareth, the area of Galilee. So this was another fellow from Galilee who rose up in the days of the census, so about the time Christ was born, if it's the same census, and drew away many people after him. So another false teacher, saying he was a Messiah, drew away people after him. It says, he also perished, and all those who obeyed him were dispersed. And now I say to you, keep away from these men and let them alone, for if this plan is the work of men, it will come to nothing. But if it is of God, you cannot overthrow it. So they agreed with him, but then they went ahead and had them beaten in verse 40 and commanded them they should not speak in the name of Jesus. So they didn't really follow Gamaliel's advice. They didn't decide to kill them, but they had them beaten anyway. Well, let's go over and look at a couple of the places that mention these two false teachers that will come on before the two witnesses of God. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13. The first individual who will come on the scene, and it'll come very quickly after him, will come the second. But the first of these two false witnesses or two false teachers will be a fellow named the Beast. We don't know his real name, but at least he follows in the pattern of the beasts as described by Daniel. He'll be the final head of the final resurrection of the Roman Empire, the fourth beast. And so we just basically call this guy the Beast. We know that he has a beastly job and a beastly title, but we don't know his actual name yet. So chapter 13 and verse 1 of Revelation, I stood on the sand of the sea, John says, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, on his horns ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. And we've studied most of those things in prophecy, and we have some pretty good charts available on our website and things if you'd like to look into that more, of course. Notice verse 2, the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. So he's very quick, he's very powerful. Notice the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. So the beast will come on the scene because God allows Satan the devil to put him there. Satan the devil is the power behind this beast. Verse 4, we'll skip verse 3. He has this deadly wound. It's kind of a miraculous thing. Verse 4, so they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like him, who was able to make war with him. So this beast controls a large civil government and a military power. And it says he's given a mouth to speak great things and blasphemies. He was given authority to continue for 42 months. So this beast power speaks things against God. Verse 6, he opens his mouth against God in blasphemy. He blasphemes God's name. Everything that has the name of God, he blasphemes. His tabernacle, the place God dwells, and of course God's Spirit dwells in his church. And so he's blaspheming God's people and those who dwell in heaven, even blasphemes the elders and the angels, angelic beings that dwell in heaven. It was granted him to make war with the saints, to overcome them, and authority was given him over every other tribe, tongue, and nation. Then we have another one down in verse 11. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. This beast is the false prophet. This fellow is the one who is the spiritual head. He's the head of a church, the great false church, and he rides the civil beast. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven. Notice he mimics Elijah. Just like the false prophets in Egypt were able to copy the first couple plagues that God performed through Moses, this false prophet will try to negate what the real prophets, the real two witnesses, are going to do, because it says they can bring down fire from heaven. So this demonic power, essentially, that controls this guy, causes even fire or lightning to come down from heaven in the sight of men. So he deceives those who dwell on the earth. They think he's one of the real two witnesses. They think that he and this other guy are the real thing, and they are proclaiming a kingdom on the earth, but of course that kingdom is Babylon, not God's kingdom. He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast whose wound was wounded by the sword and lived. And of course, that's a worldwide system of enforcement where they have have, you know, districts and, you know, sub-districts and little areas, parishes, where they're able to then enforce all that they want to enforce. Let's just follow up over in chapter 17, where we again have these two individuals, these two false prophets, who will be deceiving the world, and they will convince the world they're the two real prophets of God, or the two real witnesses of God. Chapter 17 and verse 1, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come, and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." So we have this harlot, this false religion, sitting on top of many nations or many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So her religious system, this system of sun and moon worship that has to be proclaimed as being evil, gets them drunk. They are so into it, it makes them drunk with their power and their religion. Drop down a little bit farther. Verse 6. Verse 5 is better, but let's stop it in verse 5. On her forehead there was a name written, "Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." So this new system is Babylon, but it's called God's kingdom. It's a false title they put on it. "I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus." So he's saying this new system has a connection back to the time of earlier martyrs and earlier people who have given their life for the truth. "When I saw her, I marveled with great amazement." So we have these beasts. We have this beast and false prophet, these two false teachers that will be counterfeits. And my guess is they will come on the scene just prior to the true real witnesses, and most people are going to be deceived by them. Now let's go over to Revelation chapter 11. Don't have too much more time in the next section. I don't think we'll have time to get through until next time. So I'm not sure how long this is all going to take, but there's no reason to hurry. You know, God's Word is very interesting. There's no reason to rush through it, although I've been accused of that. But now we go to Revelation 11 after giving some background. We know that two witnesses were first required to give witness against false religion, sun and moon worship. Two witnesses were also required before a death penalty for any crime that would have required the death penalty or would have measured the death penalty. Witnesses were also required as to who really owned a piece of land. So we have in chapter 11, "I was given a reed," so a measuring reed. And you can still get measuring sticks. We don't have need of it as much today. We have tape measures, and we have even electronic little gizmos that that surveyors use, and even carpenters now. You just kind of point at a wall and tells you exactly how far it is. "I was given a reed like a measuring rod." And I understand most measuring rods were 6 to 9 feet long. Some measuring rods were, what they say, 4 cubits, 5 cubits. "And the angel stood." So there's an angel there. The angel gives the rod to John. And the angel says, "Rise and measure three things." Very important that we look here and understand there are three things being measured. Number one is the temple of God. Number two is the altar. And number three is those who worship at the altar. So John is to measure all three of those things: the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship at the altar. Now, there are seven temples mentioned in the scriptures. Seven. And there are also three figurative temples. So next time we'll have to look at what are these seven temples and which one is being measured. And then we'll go on and see if we can understand more about the message of these two witnesses.